Hello everyone, and welcome again to the Associate Affiliate Cricket Podcast, our final episode of the year. We'll be doing a season-end review of some sort. We've got a couple of tournaments to chat about as well, and a few bits of news, and to join me for those is my regular co-host, Andrew Dixon. Hi, Andrew.
Hi, Russ. Hi, everybody.
The main cricket played in the last few weeks, Andrew, has been the women's tournaments. I guess we start with the biggest of those, which was the ICC Africa Women's Trophy, which was the qualifier for the global qualifier next year. It involved six teams, but one of them was a Surrey Invitational 11, and the next was Zimbabwe, who do have to qualify for that qualifier. The other four associate teams was Uganda, Namibia, Tanzania, and Kenya. And Zimbabwe showed that they're still a little bit ahead of those other nations over the course of this tournament. They went through. They lost to South Africa in the Invitational 11, which went unbeaten, but Zimbabwe won most of their games relatively comfortably throughout the tournament.
Very unfortunate that an associate couldn't pull off a win against Zimbabwe in this tournament. You'd expect in a men's event it would be a slightly different situation. But it was some good performances from Uganda and Tanzania in particular. Kenya and Namibia, I think the less said about their performance, the better. Especially Namibia. Namibia played pretty poorly throughout the tournament.
It was particularly a low-scoring tournament as well. I think there's a couple of matches here where teams were bowled out for 30 or 40 or less. But even most of the matches, most of the games where they went the full 20 overs in terms of the runs, the run rate was still only kind of 3 and 4 and over. So I guess women's cricket here, even though we're obviously not, I can only go off the scorecards, they're not scoring quickly and finding singles and so forth, perhaps as easy as the men's game.
There was only one match where both teams scored over 100. So, very low scoring, as you say. Tanzania bowled out for 24 at one point. Was perhaps the nadir of their tournament, although that was against a reasonably strong South African side. It's looking at the scorecards, wides occasionally an issue, again, as we see a lot of times in women's cricket at this level. Something that I think all associate sides in women's cricket do need to work on. And it does happen a bit with the full members as well. But, wides, not always the top scorer, as it perhaps was 10 years ago, but still a problem.
Coverage was, as usual, I think, for these, a bit of an issue. We both found out about it the day before, and the scorecards have still not been put on either ICC Africa or the Africa Cricket Association site, which is disappointing because promotion of this thing could be a lot better.
Pretty dire promotion, as is quite often the case with the Africa region. And when you're finding out about a World Cup qualifier just the day before it happens, and as you say, it's still not on the ICC website, any mention of this, and again, it's a World Cup qualifier. I can't imagine another sport not mentioning a World Cup qualifier on their governing body website. Your lack of promotion is something we talk about again and again on this podcast, and I think we're going to be talking about it a lot more in the future, and on this episode as well.
There was also an under-19 women's tournament in Africa, which weirdly was extraordinarily well promoted, because the Tanzanian Cricket Association had organised not only to put the scorecards on their website, but also live streaming of the matches on their website, and I think from the look of the live stream and some sort of coverage of the local television, so it's probably the only under-19 women's cricket anywhere being streamed, but it's fantastic, and it was good to watch a couple of games. There were six teams involved, which is, again, interesting from an under-19 tournament. There were more associates involved in the under-19s than in the main women's draw, with Uganda, Kenya, Tanzania, Botswana, Rwanda, and Mozambique all making their way there. And Uganda, for the third consecutive year, pulled off the win in the tournament in a thrilling final game, actually.
A very sort of good win for Uganda in the tournament. And, the other teams, especially when you get down to Rwanda and Mozambique, I think perhaps they're more for the experience. Rwanda have a very good development programme in place at the moment. They're doing a lot of fundraising as well. something that, you know, a lot of associate and affiliate sides perhaps need to look to do as ICC money starts to become a little more scarce. And, you know, as for live streaming, yeah, absolutely superb to see, you know, those live streamed games from an under 19 women's tournament. And it just shows up how bad a job the ICC did with the Women's World 2020 earlier in the year, which wasn't live streamed. And there was no coverage at all until the semi final stage of that tournament.
The other, I guess, interesting about this tournament is, I guess, and women's cricket in Africa is the lack of opportunities for these girls. They in some sense, some of the players have played both the under-19s and the qualifier, and then this will be pretty much the only cricket that they'll really get until next year for the next under-19 tournament and beyond. So really difficult to for their development, I think, the lack of opportunities for women's cricket in Africa.
Yeah, I think this goes for women's cricket in almost all the regions, to be honest. I mean, especially the Americas, as we've discussed, which doesn't have any women's cricket anymore. But, you know, certainly within the East Asia Pacific as well, you know, there's one tournament every couple of years. Europe, you know, the ICC Europe organise the tournament annually for Ireland, Netherlands and Scotland, but no other team gets involved. Asia is, of course, you know, far and away above the other regions for getting women's cricket tournaments played on a regular basis. But, you know, certainly within Africa, but to see an under-19 tournament with six teams in, a lot of other regions outside of Asia don't have much youth women's cricket. Europe have an under 17 tournaments, I think, for women, which is played every couple of years, but no other region has any youth tournament for women, whereas ICC Africa have done a good job organising this tournament. You know, although it's not a regular feature of the tournament calendar, it's certainly good to see that it's happened. And whether it happens in the future, we're hearing some rumours about the Africa Cricket Association. Remains to be seen, but hopefully something will take place. If not organised by ICC Africa, then organised by the associate and affiliate members in the region themselves.
Sticking with women's cricket, there was a very good to see a tournament organised between the Gulf states within the Asian cricket region. It was a 4-team tournament with the UAE, Kuwait, Qatar and Oman that was played within Oman. And the UAE came out on top, but it seemed to won all their games and seemed to play well throughout the tournament by the sounds of it, which again shows that some of their development programs are paying off.
Yeah, UAE have played in, I think, pretty much every women's tournament the Asian Cricket Council has organised in the last sort of, you know, 7 or 8 years. Perhaps no surprise that they won this, whereas, you know, the likes of Qatar, Kuwait and Oman are relatively inexperienced in women's cricket. I'm not sure about the players, whether there was, you know, many locals involved in the, you know, homegrown players involved in the teams, or whether it is predominantly expats, as you do often see with the Gulf teams. And again, it's a, you know, it's a non-ACC organised tournament, this, and you know, some of the things we're hearing about the Asian Cricket Council, these non-organised tournaments could perhaps become a more familiar sight on the tournament circuit.
Obviously, the Europeans have taken that and run with it, because the number of tournaments in Europe, most of the tournaments in Europe for associate cricket aren't organised by the ICC now, and this would seem to be another. I think it's worth mentioning too that women's cricket within these things, it's actually, this is the first of these tournaments within the Gulf states, and so it is a bit of a real step forward for them to actually have a tournament within that region and to promote women's cricket in an area that doesn't necessarily always promote women's sport very strongly.
Promotion of women's sport in Southern Asia and in the Gulf and in Arab states is often a problem. Societal issues can sometimes prevent women from playing sport and prevent sport from being promoted to women. So anytime something is done to help promote women's sport in the region, it can only be a good thing.
Other matches in the last few weeks, Andrew, we saw the one-day series between the UAE and Afghanistan, which possibly, not surprisingly, was won by the UAE. Their hold over Afghanistan seems to continue.
Yeah, Afghanistan did manage to win the third ODI. But yeah, that's only their second win over the UAE ever in one day cricket. And the UAE, you know, won the series 3-1 in the end. Should give some credit to Kurram Khan, who in the second ODI scored 132 not out. He became the oldest player ever to score an ODI century. He's 43, and it almost seems like, you know, every year goes by, he doesn't age. He's probably better now than he was so 5 or 6 years ago, and he's a superb player, and he's going to be someone they'll rely on, I think, come the World Cup. He also scored 80 odd in the third ODI, but he was then rested for the fourth ODI. We also saw the return to action for Hamid Hassan. He played in two of the four ODIs. Wasn't too successful in the second ODI where he played in. He sort of went for 64 from his 8 overs, only took one wicket, but he played in the fourth ODI, took 5 for 45, which I think is his best bowling in ODI cricket, so it's good to see him approaching his best. Hopefully he can stay fit for the World Cup and a good role for Afghanistan in that World Cup, and they'll certainly need a bowler of his calibre. I'm not too sure whether he's as good as he was before his that sort of rather horrific injury he had about 3 years ago now. But if he can get somewhere close to his best, and Afghanistan have a chance at causing a couple of surprises with their bowling in the World Cup.
Yeah, it'll be definitely difficult to see, given how long he's been out, that he'll be able to actually get back to where he was at the time. But as you say, a player of his quality, on top of the players that they already have, the opening their bowling and on Australian hard wickets, definitely makes them a dangerous attack if their batting can kind of back up the bowling.
And as often with Afghanistan, that's a big if. Sometimes the bowlers will get them into a winning position, but the batting sort of lets them down. Very much like Nepal in that respect, I suppose. But if their batting can hold things together in the World Cup, and if the bowling can do as well as we know they can, then you know they could spring a surprise or two.
Yeah. Reasonably significant tour for a couple of reasons was that Kenya went to Pakistan and played five one-day matches against Pakistan A. And I think it's fair to say that they had a very difficult tour. In fact, they basically flogged in almost all their matches. They would twice bowled out for less than 65. So not a great results for Kenya there.
No, a pretty disastrous tour all round, I suppose, for Kenya. I think certainly you go back to when these teams last played, which is quite a while ago. It's 10 years ago. They played three matches in a triangular series, and Pakistan A won two, but one of them was quite close. Kenya won another one. They played earlier in the year and were pretty close to each other. Pretty disastrous tour for Kenya, I think it's safe to say, and perhaps an indication of just how far they've fallen in recent years. And if this was preparation for World Cricket League Division 2, then it's gone badly wrong for Kenya.
Yeah, the other thing we spoke about before is that Pakistan wanting to use associates to show that the country was safe. I guess, given that why they were there, there was another very unfortunate attack on a school, but it still seems very unlikely that we'll see subsequent tours, even if possible, with associates to Pakistan.
Other than Afghanistan, I don't see any team visiting Pakistan anytime soon, which is unfortunate for them and for cricket fans in that country that they're not getting the opportunity to see international cricket. But, safety has to come first.
So, Adrian, let's look back, I guess, on the year of cricket in the associate world and the affiliate world. It's a fairly quiet year, I think, to a large degree, except for the World Cup qualifiers that were in January. There wasn't a huge amount of cricket over the course of the year. We still managed to roll this episode out every few weeks to talk about bits and pieces, but certainly compared to the previous year where we had, particularly for the large nations, the Intercontinental Cup and the World Cricket League Championship, this year has been a year where there's been sporadic tournaments, a lot of tournaments that weren't actually organised by the ICC, and not a huge amount of promotion of associate cricket, I think it's fair to say.
Yeah, I think it's perhaps a sign of things to come in some way. So some global tournaments taking place and very few regional tournaments, and the regional tournaments that are taking place not organised by official governing bodies. It's an unfortunate sign of things to come, I think. And as for sort of promotion of cricket throughout the year, has been pretty disastrous, I think, for the most part. The Asian Cricket Council has again done a very good job. We have to say they've had most of their tournaments with live coverage on Cricinfo, you know, a very relatively high profile for their usual tournaments. East Asia Pacific did a good job of organising their women's tournament, their men's tournaments. They use social media very well. The other three regions, I think, less well. ICC Europe put out a newsletter every month or so, but it's a spin-off of the All Out Cricket magazine. Nothing against All Out Cricket. It's, you know, from what I've read, it's a, you know, pretty good magazine. But when you read the ICC Europe newsletter, and two-thirds of it is about, you know, full member cricket, it's a bit disappointing. I saw, you know, one issue that was 16 pages, eight of which were an interview with MS Dhoni. You know, what he has to do with European cricket, you know, I have no idea. But you know, at least ICC Europe are actually putting out a newsletter. ICC Americas and ICC Africa, as we discussed earlier, for ICC Africa, are pretty terrible at promoting their events, I think it's safe to say.
Yeah, and I mean, not just promotion, their events, just even news of what's happening is very difficult to get through. I guess the question is this a funding issue? Is it a structural issue that then they're not actually capable of doing this within the structure, the existing structures, or with the funding that they get? Or is it something that they're not focused on at all, and therefore they're not worried about what's happening outside? They find that all they really care about is to promote it amongst their member nations and the members there, and that they don't feel the need to actually say, hey, this is actually what's happening within cricket in our region, to actually get coverage within a slightly wider media, the wider cricket media, the wider associate cricket groups and social media.
I think it's a combination of all those things. When it comes to actual sort of promotion through, say, social media, the organisations might get someone to do it for a while. They'll get a volunteer who will set up a Twitter account for ICC Americas or ICC Africa or whatever, but then that volunteer moves on and starts doing something else, and the promotion dies in that respect. You know, that sort of thing, your volunteers moving on to something else has been you know, something that's affected associate cricket for, you know, 40 odd years now, and it will no doubt continue to do so. But to some extent, you know, I think the ICC need to play more of a role in this. They are, for all their faults, the governing body of cricket. It may not always seem that way, but they are. And they should be the ones promoting these events. They should be the ones putting their World Cup qualifying tournaments on their website. You know, you would not see FIFA not mention a World Cup qualifier somewhere on their website, same for International Rugby Board, same for your FIBA, the basketball governing body, or the IIHF for ice hockey. They all will mention all their international tournaments somewhere on their website. They'll give them pride of place. Cricket doesn't do that. Cricket focuses, you know, as we know, on the very narrow top of the game and neglects these things. I think the ICC needs to put requirements on these World Cup qualifying tournaments to provide, you know, even just press releases. Your live scorecards would be great, but, you know, sort of press releases with even short scores on, I think it should be the bare minimum that these tournaments should be producing for everyday's play.
Yeah, FIFA's an interesting contrast because obviously FIFA's regional bodies are actually extremely strong and they promote very strongly the football that's played within those regions and their own competitions. And that then is fed back up into FIFA's at a global level. And what we see in the regions is that they're really just branch offices of the ICC. The Asian Cricket Council is exceptions to this rule, but in general, they are ICC events that feed within the ICC structure, and yet they're just run as the local branch is running it, and they're not promoted as this is the Asian Championship or this is the European Championship, because the major nations of Asia or Europe aren't involved in those tournaments, and meaning the Test nations, and so therefore it doesn't have that cachet to say this is what's going on. It's a lower level regional qualifier to go into a global qualifier, which is important to the ICC. And therefore, really, the ICC probably needs to say, well, this is our tournament. We're going to have to do the legwork to promote these, because it's not something that the regions have a coherent strategy throughout them to show that they sit within this broader structure.
Yeah, I know. For example, ICC Europe does have a media officer who will, who will issue press releases. It's a little variable what comes out, and the ICC Europe Twitter account will sometimes go dark even during tournaments. So, again, it's the problem of people having other things to do as well. I don't know about the other regions. Obviously, we know with Asia, Sharia Khan, who we've had on this podcast a couple of times, does a very good job at promoting their tournaments. And the other three regions, we don't see as much from. I wouldn't be able to tell you who the media relations people are in the other three regions. And sometimes you contact the ICC and they don't really seem to know who's the best person to contact. You ask for a media contact and they give you the head of... I asked for a media contact for ICC Africa and I got the head of ICC Africa. That's not the person who should be dealing with the media. His job should be to be organising things at the very top. There should be a media relations person to be for me to contact rather than contacting the boss. And it's that lack of consistency between the regions. The ICC will tell you that trying to bring more of them to become your actual branch offices of the ICC, for that, rather than pseudo branch offices as they are now, will help to sort of rationalise that and make it more consistent. But we know from the past that the ICC's commitment to promoting these tournaments is somewhat lacking.
Well, that's right. So if that happens, and it's probably worth getting some news that there's some rumours going about that the Africa Cricket Association could be disbanded at the end of this month, at the end of the year, it then would depend entirely on the commitment out of Dubai to do this promotion and to get these tournaments out there. And their record of kind of catering to fans going to tournaments is pretty bad. They still haven't released the dates, for instance, for the World 2020 qualifiers in July next year. They didn't release the dates for the World Cup qualifiers in January this year until, I think, November of the previous year, which is extremely late in terms of getting to the flights and things for people who wanted to go across there. Not that there were a huge amount of them, but I did know at least one person who was very inconvenienced by this. So it's difficult for fans of Associate Cricket, and you're not going to get fans of Associate Cricket unless you can do that kind of promotion.
No, you're absolutely right. And you're going back to the ICC not being that interested in these events. I pointed out at one point to an ICC media relations officer that the ICC Africa website hadn't been updated since early 2013, and in fact was still advertising tickets for the 2013 Champions Trophy in England, and she had absolutely no idea that that was the case. So obviously they hadn't been paying attention to what ICC Africa was doing with their website and with their tournaments and whatnot. And so that doesn't bode well if we hear that the Africa Cricket Association, which obviously does the job of ICC Africa to some extent, is going, and what's going to be put there in its place? You know, are we actually going to see African tournaments promoted? Are we going to see European tournaments promoted? Are we going to see Asian tournaments promoted, etc.? We're going to see them all promoted adequately, and unfortunately, it would seem the answer to that is no.
One of the other major themes of the year was the ascension from how do you move from being associate into a test playing nation, and the ICC was quite keen to bring forward the idea that they've created the ICC Test Challenge, which will allow the winner of which to play England in 2019. That if the winner is an associate nation, they still have to beat one of Zimbabwe or Bangladesh, presumably Zimbabwe, to actually gain that, and for it then to be carried through.
Time will tell whether or not this is actually real. You know, there's a lot of time between now and 2018 when the Test Challenge is scheduled for, and you know, that's a lot of time for things to change in the ICC, for politics to be played, for people to get out of things. Zimbabwe Cricket have themselves already announced that they're actually playing England at Lords in 2019, which caused the ECB on Twitter to point out, it's actually going to be against the winners of the ICC Test Challenge. I think Zimbabwe have perhaps had if this is not too cynical, which you know doesn't normally stop us, Zimbabwe have perhaps had a tip off that actually they're going to be playing in that Test match. Really, the Test Challenge maybe isn't what we think it is. Which, to be fair, I've thought all along that it isn't what people think it is. You know, the idea of status is something we discuss a lot on this program. I think we are starting to win the argument a bit to some extent. I think more people realise that it's a little silly. And when you actually look at results this year, and you look at your associates being in full members, you look at non-ODI status teams beating ODI status teams, non-2020 status teams beating 2020 status teams, affiliates beating associates. I think there's been almost 50 matches this year where that's happened, and it just goes to show that the dividing lines between the teams with different statuses aren't as clear as people might like to think.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we saw the now one-day international stateless Netherlands be the best-performing associate of the world at 2020. We've seen Netherlands and Nepal doing very well there as well, even though they had been one of the worst two teams at the World Cup qualifiers. We saw Malaysia beat Afghanistan, and they're well down the ranks there. The World Cup qualifiers itself, we ended up with the farcical situation of the 9th and 10th playoff being a one-day match and the final not being a one-day match, which it's easy to point out the anomalies because there's so many of them in this sort of situation.
Yeah, you know, we could go on. You know, and the basic principle is that if you set a limit of a number of teams with status at X, the team at X plus one is always capable of beating the team at X, and that goes right down. You know, so why have a limit at all? Why not just have your international matches rather than international matches of a certain status? And we don't see any sign of the ICC changing that anytime soon. And in fact, you know, we could perhaps see things move backwards from where they are now.
Let's speak briefly about X plus one in terms of test status, which is Ireland. They dominated last year, and they've been the best team going around for a few years now. There's periodic calls for them to be ascended to a test playing nation. The most recent was Jason Gillespie, which is good in the sense that at least a former player from a major, one of the big three countries is putting forward this idea. But again, it seemed like a relatively naive kind of piece in the sense that it doesn't address a large number of what are basically structural and financial issues with just bringing Ireland forward. If you can't necessarily bring them into the existing structure, and I'm not sure that's necessarily appreciated.
Yeah, I mean, to start with, first, you know, the idea that Ireland deserves test status, the idea that any team that test status is something that is deserved is actually why Ireland aren't already playing tests. I think it's important to point out that. And then just looking at Gillespie's comments specifically, he said bringing in Ireland will help make test cricket exciting. You know, the problem with test cricket isn't because not enough teams are playing, it's because there's no real point to test cricket to some extent. You know, we see outside of you know, the Ashes, matches are you know, pretty sparsely attended, and even the Ashes, you know, the ticket sales for, you know, the 2015 series aren't as strong as they were for 2013 at this stage. And, you know, there's no structure to test cricket. I think that's why it's not particularly exciting. You know, it's matches for the sake of playing matches. It's a structure of sport from the 19th century, that's still existing, you know, 14 years into the 21st century. And that's what needs to change for test cricket to become exciting. Not just adding teams for the sake of adding teams, but adding teams and putting them into a structure that will help promote test cricket. You know, this idea of teams going on tour, I think is a bit of, as I say, it's something from the past. It's not needed anymore. You go back, you know, even as recently as, you know, 25, 30 years ago, and seeing the best players in the world was quite a unique experience. You know, it didn't happen very often. You'd either see them on TV now and again, or you know, you'd have to go and see them, you know, in the matches when the touring side came to your country. But now you don't have that. You see the best players in the world on TV every week. They probably play for your local 2020 team. And the concept of touring, I think, is something from the past, and I think that's the problem with Test cricket. Not the fact that we need to bring in Ireland necessarily. Oh, well, obviously I want to see Ireland play Test cricket. I want to see Afghanistan play Test cricket and so on and so forth. Just adding a team, I think, isn't going to solve the problems with Test cricket. You know, I described it on Twitter as it's putting a sticking plaster on an axe wound.
Yeah, I think definitely too, when you talk about Ireland, it's sometimes portrayed as the idea that, well, we could bring this team in and it'd be a bit like when South Africa came in. Almost, they don't say it in that terms, and they're probably not quite that hopeful. But it's implied that it's going to be this new and exciting team that will have all these players that people can be excited to go and see, and that'll add a whole bunch of new competitive matches. And look, with respect to Ireland, if they came into Test cricket, they would not be even at New Zealand's standard in general in terms of the way they were going to play. They're going to be at the same level as Bangladesh and Zimbabwe, which means they're going to get pretty much the same level of matches as in Bangladesh and Zimbabwe, because for starters there's no space within the future touring program for them to play. But even when they do play, most of their matches are probably not going to be that competitive. They're probably going to lose almost all the tests they play against everyone that's West Indies and below by sometimes significant margins. And that's not going to promote Ireland as a test nation. And obviously the Irish cricket itself realises that they're not at that position either to play it. But it certainly, it would be naive, and it is naive, to suggest that, well, we can just bring in new nations and they will be able to promote Test cricket by making it exciting. And uncompetitive games without any sort of structure aren't actually going to be that exciting. They're going to be exactly what we've already got, and there's just going to be more of them, or the same number of them, but spread out more because between more teams, which isn't a way forward for Test cricket. There needs to be a structure in place that takes into account the fact that actually Ireland and Afghanistan and those teams below them are in general not going to be able to be more than competitive at home and maybe on the odd occasion competitive away.
Yeah, as you say, if there's a structure for Ireland to come into that enables them to play at an appropriate level until they can, you know, slowly rise up and other teams slowly drop down, as may be the case, that would help them help make Test cricket more exciting, but it help Ireland ease in gently. But there's currently isn't really a way for them to ease in gently. they sort of thrown in at the deep end and expected to swim. And that's not going to work. That's not going to make Test cricket better. If anything, it's going to make Test cricket worse.
Let's move on, Andrew, to a bit more reviewing of the highlights and so forth of the year. Personally, personal highlights, cricket you've seen and which matches stood out for you over the course of the year?
I think, you know, it's hard to go past that Netherlands v Ireland game at the World 2020 where we saw the Netherlands chasing, you know, 190 in 14 overs. I think, I don't think it'll be a long time before we see a 2020 international like that in, you know, with that sort of much riding on it. You know, you may see it in a one-off 2020 performance like that, you know, one-off context of 2020, but see it in an important, crucial game, a must-win game for the Netherlands, and must-win by that margin as well. That was just superb. And in the same tone, I think, you know, the game between Hong Kong and Bangladesh, although not as high-scoring, was equally as exciting. And then, you know, later in sort of Netherlands against England, you know, beating England again in 2020 international, and, you know, the Netherlands, you know, they had that hiccup against Sri Lanka, but they actually performed with some credit in that Super 10 stage of the World 2020. They were in a winning position against South Africa and were in a winning position against New Zealand, and, you know, weren't a million miles away, really, when you look at it, from making the semi-finals of that tournament. And, you know, I think Netherlands did Associate Cricket proud in that tournament.
Yeah, absolutely. The other game in that tournament that was really good to watch and really highlighted, I think, Associate Cricket was Nepal versus Afghanistan, which I think really generated a fair bit of interest in that section of the tournament, which hadn't maybe perhaps always been there when it had started, but there was a lot of other matches, well, warm-up matches being promoted ahead of it.
Yeah, and, you know, it ended up being the first time Nepal beat Afghanistan in, you know, since I think 2004. It was great for Nepal. And as you mentioned there, you know, the warm up matches being promoted ahead of it. This comes back to what we were talking about earlier, the promotion of Associate Cricket. You know, we saw that World 2020 warm up matches were televised. You know, and in England certainly we saw actual tournament matches being relegated to, you know, an interactive stream behind the warm-up match on the main channel, and that all sort of ties into the promotion aspect of it as well. And but, you know, I think the Associates certainly in that first round did win a lot of friends. I think it's unfortunate that the format of that World 2020 was what it was, but we did at least get to see that amazing match, as we say, between Ireland and Netherlands. We got to see Hong Kong beat Bangladesh, Hong Kong's first win over a full member in their history. You know, it was an exciting tournament, I think, for Associate Cricket, despite the format.
Looking back a little earlier, another personal highlight was the Scotland-Kenya game, which saw Scotland qualify for the World Cup. It was a cold day in Christchurch, but it was a thrilling match to be able to see them chase down a target that for a little while was touch and go, and for Kenya, who were fighting themselves to keep within the top tier structure, to go down fighting for a while until eventually Rob Taylor put the game away.
Yeah, and, you know, that came with Scotland under a lot of pressure. You know, they'd lost their opening tournament match to Hong Kong, and then they basically had to win, I think, sort of six or seven matches in a row to be able to get to the World Cup, and, you know, they managed to pull it off, and that was again a must-win game for them, and, you know, and they did the job, and they went on to, you know, beat the UAE in the final. And Scotland, that was a big turnaround from, they had a pretty dreadful World 2020 qualifier, and you saw interviews with the coaching staff saying, you know, just like Scotland didn't care. And you know, I think after that defeat against Hong Kong in the first match of that World Cup qualifier, I think that was perhaps, you know, the kick up the backside that Scotland needed in that tournament. And you know, they got through, they were assisted well with a strong coaching staff. Paul Collingwood has got involved with the coaching for that tournament, and he will be back for the World Cup, and someone of his experience brings a lot to Scottish cricket, and Scotland, I think, perhaps not particularly well placed in the World Cup to pull off an upset, but who knows? And it could be Scotland's last hurrah in the World Cup for some time, and they'll be wanting to go out with a bang, so to speak. And as you say, they had that good World Cup qualifier match against Kenya, and they know how to play in crucial games, and that's a good experience for them.
And in the World Cricket League tournaments, we saw, I think both Jersey and Malaysia definitely had standout years. Jersey had already jumped up to Division 5, then moved up again to Division 4, which was a really outstanding effort in Malaysia to do that. And Malaysia worked their way up through 4 and 3 to as well. Some fine performances in the World Cricket League's tournaments there. And that's really set up for the tournament in January for the World Cricket League Division 2, which is now carrying so much significance for the six teams involved in that.
Yeah, that Division 2 tournament is looking set to be one of the most exciting World Cricket League tournaments ever, I think. Nepal and Uganda come up from Division 3. They've been sort of yo-yo in between Divisions 2 and 3 for some time now, especially Uganda. And I think they need to start staying in Division 2 at least, if not progressing into the Intercontinental Cup and World Cricket League Championship. We're not exactly sure how many teams will go into the Intercontinental Cup. I hear tale that it might not be an 8-team tournament, there's a possibility of it being a 10-team tournament, which would be great to see. So we'll see what comes of that. And Namibia, playing on home territory, they're going to be looking for the success in Kenya. Kenya and Canada, you can't always rule them out despite the lack of their build up. And it's going to be Netherlands, of course, as we've already talked about them. They're a good side as well, and that's going to be a really good tournament to start the year with.
And performances of the year, players of the year, I think we mentioned Scotland already. Preston Momsen, who won the ICC Associate Cricketer of the Year, he scored just a huge number of runs in that World Cup qualifier towards the tail end of the tournament to really drag them home. And obviously, who was also already mentioned on the podcast, Kurram Khan, again, he really had an outstanding tournament as well and an outstanding year again to bring those two teams into the World Cup.
And also in the World Cup qualifier, Callum McLeod scored that 175 against Canada, and he had a big innings against the UAE as well. He had a big innings, big century later in the year against the Netherlands as well in that non-ODI up in Scotland, where he scored 145 from 124 balls. He had a good year. And for Papua New Guinea, Legacy Yaka scored a couple of centuries in that World Cup qualifier, and then again in their ODI against Hong Kong later in the year, and he was very successful in the East Asia Pacific Trophy just last month. There's been a lot of players who have had a very good year, and hopefully they can carry that form forward into next year as well.
Yeah, I do wonder when we talk about a lot of these players that it's hard to think of bowlers who had very good years, and it's definitely the case, I think, that the associate cricket bowling is perhaps maybe even a bit of a low ebb at the moment, and so it would be good to see some more bowlers coming through. I think a few years ago it was definitely stronger than it is now.
I think certainly in the past the top associate players were nearly always bowlers, and that's not really the case now, and whether that's a sign of 2020 cricket perhaps making the life of a bowler a bit more difficult, I don't know. But there are some the Aminis for Papua New Guinea bowl well. Louis Klazinga had a sort of reasonable World Cup qualifier for Namibia, although Namibia weren't overly successful in the tournament. And, you know, there are some bowlers coming up. Majid Haque for Scotland, of course, and obviously Ahsan Malik as well had a good year for the Netherlands. He took a six for against Scotland in that unofficial one-day match back in July. So there are some bowlers coming through. You know, Amjad Khan's come back for Denmark this year, and he's still a pretty decent bowler. But yeah, it's definitely been a year for batsmen as far as associate cricket goes.
Women's cricket, it's been a fairly quiet year. There was no World Cup qualifiers. I think often women's cricket is a pretty quiet year, but it's really hard to think of much women's cricket at all this year that's actually even happened, and just a bit disappointing that we haven't really seen enough even to talk about who's had good years, because really even the players that had opportunities only had maybe two or three opportunities over the course of the year.
Yeah, you know, Isabel Joyce was think perhaps just about stands out as someone who had a good year, but yeah, there's been so little women's cricket this year, you know, at associate level. It's actually quite hard to pick anything. You know, the four members have their women's one-day championship now, and it's unfortunate that something a second division for that couldn't have been put in for the associates. Obviously, the budget just isn't there for it.
And your take on the state of associate cricket, Andrew, is it's been an interesting year. It's not actually clear, I guess, exactly where associate cricket's going. I think it's a little bit still up in the air. Maybe they've made some decisions that we're going to find out about at the start of next year. But is it better than it was? Is it worse?
I think at the moment it's looking like associate cricket is in a worse place than it was 12 months ago. The big three reforms have left associate cricket in. Sort of wondering what the future is. It looks like the top tier of associates are going to still be looked after, but the further down the pecking order you go, the less rosy a future we have, and that's extremely unfortunate. And I think associate cricket in general, we're approaching the 50th anniversary of associate cricket existing, as it were. 1965 was the year the ICC expanded to have associate members. Fiji, USA and Sri Lanka, or Ceylon as they still were then, were the first associate members elected in July 1965. So July this coming year will be the 50th anniversary of that. And you have to say in that time the ICC has had 100 new members, and only three of them have gone on to become full members. And you have to say that 50 years of associate cricket hasn't been particularly successful in the long run, and it's not looking like that's going to be changing anytime soon, unfortunately.
Yeah, it's interesting to look, I think, at the last 10 years that it was about that long ago that the associate cricket had a bit of a run with the ICC. You can look back at their annual reports from that period now and see that how keen they were and how enthused they were by the new regional structures and the new structures they'll put in place and where they thought associate cricket was going to go. And I feel like there's been a level of, well, we tried this and it didn't actually work, and now they've really pulled back from the idea that they can promote cricket as a global game, most of the nations that they brought into the fold as ICC associate or as ICC affiliate members, there's not a lot of cricket being played in those nations, and they're not necessarily sure what they can do with them, because they don't have the resources, at least at the ICC level. They probably do within the context of the ICC budget, if it wasn't being spread out throughout the four members to promote and expand the sport within those at a grassroots level. And they haven't really been able to succeed in terms of lifting a team from an associate level to test nation level, just because, again, they weren't quite there. They needed more than just some money and some coaching. They needed a larger grassroots build-up. And so I feel like they've kind of hit the reset button and said, well, we're going to try a different strategy, but it's not really clear necessarily what that strategy might be or how ambitious it's going to going to be. I feel that they've pulled back from the ambitions that they had.
Yeah, I think to some extent the teams that have risen up the pecking order in recent years have done so almost in spite of the ICC, not because of the ICC. You know, the rise of Afghanistan was to some extent nothing to do with the ICC. You know, Ireland climbing up the rankings as well. You know, that was sort of internally within Ireland to some extent. Papua New Guinea they got a very committed CEO who did a lot for bringing on Papua New Guinea and cricket, and they've got a lot of sponsors regionally, and perhaps that's what associates now need to do. They need to look at raising their own funds and doing things themselves, because the ICC sure isn't going to help them.
Moving on to some news then. I think this tail end of the year, there's not a huge number of things going on, but governance has been a bit of a theme over the course of this year, and it's still something that's ongoing in several nations. Nepal is starting to get a little bit confusing in terms of what's happening. It seems that the existing governing body, CAN, has kind of dug their heels in terms of being disbanded, and they've been organising parts of the pre-tours for World Cricket League Division 2, but there's also been another body set up, which is the support of the Supreme Court, that is also involved, and that's a bit of a worry for cricket in Nepal, that they seem to have this internal fighting going on over the restructure.
Yeah, and you're especially worrying because they are on notice from the ICC at the moment, and if they still have these two governing bodies come July, then Nepal will be suspended from the ICC. They are not expelled. They'll still remain an ICC member, but they won't be able to take part in tournaments, which would be a disastrous outcome for Nepal. You know, they'll be playing in the World Cup, World 2020 qualifier around that time, and if they could find themselves finishing in that top six of that tournament, and then not able to play in the World 2020 the next year because they'll be suspended from the ICC, and that would just be disastrous. And Nepal is an associate that has a lot of potential. You know, they're one of the ones who have managed to do things themselves rather than rely on the ICC, and the last thing they need is for these governance problems to knock them back. And governors of Nepali cricket has often held them back in the past, and it could hold them back even more disastrously than it has previously, and they really need to sort this stuff out.
We're seeing as well a continuation of entrepreneurial 2020 leagues popping up in associate countries. The Canadian Premier League has been scrapped. Scrapped might be the wrong word, but Cricket Canada has refused to endorse it, which basically makes it dead in the water in terms of getting big name players there, because it needs that endorsement in order to make it official cricket.
I think the Canadian Premier League was always dead in the water. It was being set up by a guy who is a convicted fraudster. He was coming up with all sorts of outlandish claims. He was going to build a whatever it was, $100 billion stadium or whatever, however much money it was. It was a ridiculous one, an indoor stadium as well, so they could play all year round. He was going to take over the Olympic Stadium in Montreal, the former home of the Montreal Expos baseball team, and use that for the tournament. He'd even apparently coaxed Sachin Tendulkar out of retirement to come and play in the league. The idea that this league was ever going to get off the ground, I think, was always wrong. And Cricket Canada, they do a lot of things wrong, but I think making sure they didn't get involved with Roy Singh was a very good move on their part.
We know the list. There's some tendering going around for what's going to be called the Mediterranean Premier League. It smacks of a very similar type of thing where they're going to get some franchises and some players to play in Europe in grounds to be unknown, and get those franchises to play small tournaments over the course of the year, and it's a little bit up in the air, but it does, again, it seems like one of those things that they think they might make a lot of money out of if they could do stuff, but it doesn't seem to have the official endorsement anywhere.
No, they've announced various teams as playing in this, you know, one in, a team in Croatia, a team in France, a team in Greece, and one other team, the location of which escapes me at the moment. But apparently these aren't actual teams that actually exist. They're identities for teams that are available for purchase, which strikes me as a very odd way to do business. I mean, you know, the normal franchise model is that you'd put out a tender and see who's interested, and then that's where your teams end up being. And yeah, this is, you know, it's somewhere towards the Canadian Premier League scale of plausibility scale, and there is to some extent a Wild West nature to 2020 cricket at the moment, and you see these leagues popping up, or proposed leagues should we say, popping up now and again. And even in full members, you had the Bangladesh Premier League get set up, and that turned out to be something of a disaster. Ended up in sort of various match fixing allegations, and if full members aren't getting it right, then I can't see associate and affiliate in some cases members getting it right either.
Yeah, I feel like this is one of those. Wild West is a good description because it's people coming in and saying we can do this or we can do that, and with some or little or no endorsement of, or and certainly no structure or no strategic plan in place for this is how we can leverage a league like this to promote cricket. If you look at Big Bash League in Australia, it's very tightly controlled by Cricket Australia, and it's being used to promote cricket to women and children, and then use that to try and build up a product that they can sell on and make money over a long period of time. And there is no possible good outcome that can come unless that's the structure that's put in place, unless that's the strategic plan that's put in place. And for associate and affiliate members, it would not be a bad thing necessarily to have some sort of league of semi-professional or amateur status that does actually exist as franchises within that, and that players can play in and would build up cricket's profile and allow them to promote cricket around those regions. But doing it through an entrepreneur who's just there to make money and is going to try and make a lot of promises that aren't necessarily going to come to fruition, and even if they do, they're probably going to get most of the profits and run off with them, is not the way to promote cricket, and not the way to use a 2020 franchise league, which as I say, could be valuable in some of these places, but it's got to come through the associate affiliate members that they need to think about how they can strategize in the thing and talk about it amongst themselves, and not just jump into bed with these people who are very much an unknown quantity.
Yeah, there's nothing necessarily wrong with partnering with some sort of commercial enterprise, but it needs to be the associate and affiliate members themselves take something to a commercial partner rather than a commercial partner bringing something to the cricket boards or even just not going through the cricket boards at all. It has to be led by the governing bodies themselves, and that's not happening at the moment. So that's what we saw in Canada. It's what we no doubt see with this Mediterranean Premier League as well.
And it's what we see regularly in the United States, of course, which has probably had, what, four or five of these types of things come and go and not leave anything behind.
Yeah, you're absolutely right.
Couple of piece of good news. The Legacy RQ we mentioned had a good year, has picked up a Big Bash contract as a rookie for Melbourne Renegades, so really great if he can get out in the field. He's obviously an electric fielder and a very promising batsman, so that's good. And we saw a similar news item from the Americas region that young cricketers from that region will be playing within the youth competition that precedes the Caribbean Premier League, and therefore have an opportunity to take a roster spot within those Caribbean Premier League teams, which would be great for if any of those players can take that opportunity.
It's a fantastic opportunity for them. It's currently restricted to just Canada, Bermuda, and the USA, which I think you'd probably expect with those being the top teams in the region, just about for Bermuda and the USA, I think. I think looking at the lineup of the players who are in there, you'd certainly look at Stephen Taylor to be coming out of that, and perhaps Nitish Kumar for Canada. It's your two homegrown players as well, which if one of them can play in the Caribbean Premier League, it'll be great for the countries concerned. Well, Stephen Taylor obviously has already stated his intention to try and play for the West Indies in the future. But who can blame him if nobody would begrudge him playing for the West Indies to the USA, although the West Indies are hardly in a good state administratively at the moment. It's a very good opportunity for these young players, and hopefully one of them can get that contract in the Caribbean Premier League and play against some of the top players in the world.
Finally, we Paul Baldwin, who is a member of the associate panel, has been named on the ECB's first class umpire list for 2015, which is good for him, but he's getting that kind of career progression to maybe move his way up to test days, but I think, as you mentioned before, perhaps disappointing that he couldn't just bridge the gap from associate and affiliate cricket directly to the world cricket's panel, the test panel.
Yeah, he was on the associate and affiliate panel until 2009. There is a theoretical pathway to progress from the associate and affiliate panel to the international panel, which is obviously the backup to the elite panel to some extent. But I think it was made clear to him that your umpiring in Germany, as he was at the time, wasn't going to mean he was umpiring at a high enough level to be able to progress to that international panel. So although that pathway is there, it isn't really. It's a bit like the pathway to test status for associates, as it were. Paul Baldwin went from umpiring one internationals in 2009 to umpiring county under 17 games in 2010, and I think it's questionable whether that is real career progression. And if umpires can't go straight from that associate and affiliate panel to the international panel, then why not go from the associate and affiliate panel to umpiring county cricket or state cricket in Australia? And perhaps there needs to be some sort of exchange program put in place where the top European umpires can umpire county cricket, and the top East Asia Pacific umpires can umpire in state cricket in Australia or New Zealand, and so on and so forth. Perhaps that's a way around this in the future. And I don't think it's right that an umpire should have to go from umpiring one day internationals to umpiring county under 17 games. No disrespect to county under 17 players. I'm sure they're very competitive players, but I don't think it's real progression to go from ODIs to under 17 county cricket. But it's good for Paul Baldwin to be umpiring first class cricket in England, and with a possibility of getting perhaps onto the international panel in the not too distant future. It's good for him, but the whole, I think, umpire pathway needs to be looked at. We spoke about it on the previous episode at a lower level, and the whole thing needs to be looked at for sure.
And that's the end of our second year of podcasting. It doesn't seem that long, but that's what the dates say. Merry Christmas to all our listeners and to you, Andrew, and we'll see you again next year.
Same to you, and I hope all our listeners have a good Christmas and a good New Year.